gentlemen, how good to see you. Good morning, madam. Sir, beautiful day.
Christmas to you, sir.
Good morning, my dear. What a lovely day.
The Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, episode 141, for December 8th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Jean-Luc Picard.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
It's the holiday season, Chip. You could be whomever you wish. Baldly go wherever you want to go.
Exactly.
Explain yourself, sir.
Well, Jean-Luc Picard reads a little bit of the Christmas Carol. Steve?
There are characters and there are actors. There are differences between these humans, sir.
With Earl Grey tea. Make Earl it Grey. So, Steve.
Yes, Patrick Stewart, the well-known actor, Patrick Stewart, did a version of A Christmas Carol. That's one of the things that we really know about A Christmas Carol is everybody's done a version of this, right?
Martin Sheen has done a version of it.
So the Mickey President, Mouse?
Mickey Mouse, of course.
The Muppets?
Exactly. Everyone who is someone.
God bless us, everyone who is someone.
So let me ask you guys, had you actually read the novel before this week? I mean, I think we all know the story, but was this a first reading of the novel or are you coming back to it?
That is an interesting question. This story is so well known. I cannot help but think that I had read it at some point. But I'm going to say this is a first reading just because it'll be a lot easier.
Chip, I had the exact same experience because I think I even told you guys, I haven't read this before. I've read a lot of Dickens, a lot of really big, you know, paperweight kinds of Dickens novels, Oliver Twist, David Copperfield, Pickwick Papers. I thought I hadn't read this, but then as I was reading, I was like, maybe I have read it before.
I'm in exactly the same boat. Yeah. I don't think that I've ever read this before, but I know this story. And there were no surprises for me.
Right.
There was nothing in it that I went, oh, I didn't know that was going to occur. I didn't know that that verbiage was not going to... It was all very known.
Which is super fascinating, right? Considering that when we read Dracula, right, we thought we knew the Dracula story, but the novel has so many, you know, untapped areas that we don't see in film adaptations and other kinds of adaptations. Whereas I think A Christmas Carol is pretty fully adapted and integrated into the popular imagination.
And I think that stems directly from the original writing. I think Charles Dickens wrote this for his own narrative on stage, that he created this story tight. This is a tight, well-crafted tale that you can imagine he standing on stage with a podium reading this to you with such exuberance, and you hear in the words where he put this together that all the adaptations are truly set up for success here.
Now, do you know if that's true? Because I'm not sure if it is. This was written and released as a serial, wasn't it?
I don't believe that this was ever published in a periodical. I believe this was a book, a novel, a novella.
So guys, the Victorian period is obviously a super long one since Victoria was on the throne from 1837 all the way through 1901. Now, I only work on the end of the period, right? I really start getting excited around 1880. This is right at the beginning of the Victorian period. So 1843, 44. I mean, we are literally 175 years in the past. Wow. So this is decades, four and a half decades before Sherlock Holmes, who we've been spending time with. But it's kind of interesting that Victorian period is so lengthy. And you can see a lot of the same themes that we see in late Victorian. It's a very different world, but still a world that's very, very concerned with questions of class, questions of identity, questions of epistemology, as I'm always interested in, we are already seeing that beginning of science versus religion, different modes of like moral and ethical questions. And so this is fun. I'm really glad that we're going all the way back to the 1840s to think about these early holiday texts.
Well, Steve, obviously it was something so old. There's probably a few adaptations out there.
It's one of those stories, right? It's one of those stories that we've seen this. We know this story because it has been used so many times in the last 175 years.
And, you know, it's in the public domain, so I'm sure Dickens is probably getting a lot of money for this.
No, probably not. The public domain is certainly in the public trust, but it's such a well-written story. I'm coming back to this point again. It is so tightly put together. We know what's going to happen to this miser. He's going to have a change of heart. We know the three ghosts are going to come and visit him on three nights, and it's a frightening tale of ghosts and seeing specters that leads us to this epiphany that maybe, just maybe, being happy is more important than the riches that Scrooge has.
Well, I'm not really sure if that we're going to go that far, but I mean, certainly we're going to explore Scrooge and sort of the misery he has.
He is definitely miserable, and he finds a way to hopefully change his ways and change his misery.
And I think this brings us to one of the really big questions that we can always ask about literature. Can literature have an impact, right? Can a work of fiction actually change people's minds about things? And as a sort of transformation story, and one that's set in the holiday season and brought back out every year, is this a story that actually changes people's minds? Has it had the impact of having people open up their wallets, donate more to charity, be more, you know, what are the impacts? And when we ask that question about the power of literature to actually have an impact, we often go to Uncle Tom's Cabin, right? That little novel that started the Great Big War, and its impact on changing people's minds about slavery. And Christmas Carol is also one of those stories that gets seen as an actual novel that makes people more charitable. And whenever you look at these kinds of novels, you have to think about the balance between telling a great story and like being didactic, giving people a lesson. And one of the questions I had for you guys was, did this feel like overly didactic as you're reading it? Or was it a good enough story that you were just engaged and reading along and just feeling good?
Well, I'm going to answer that as in I was reading this story. And while I knew the beats, I know every part of it. I mean, certainly any adaptation today is fully articulated. I enjoyed reading it. I enjoyed the experience of going back through it. And there's the real part of it was I didn't think I was going to enjoy it, because if I have to go to another play or watch another movie, it seems tiresome. But reading it seemed to bring it back alive.
I really do see that messaging being very heavy in this. I think that there is a moral to the story that is heavy-handed, but I still love it. I still love the idea of this miser, this terrible, terrible man who everybody hates. The people on the street don't even want to talk to him. That's how much they hate him. And he goes through this night, or three nights, depending on how you imagine that this is really happening, and he has that change of heart. And yes, it's heavy-handed. Yes, there's a message about charity and caring about others, and I still love it.
But in today's society, we're much more aware of how a person's experiences impact them throughout their entire lives. And so as we go, we eventually will explore the past. you recognize that was he conditioned for that? Was there something that happened that made him, basically the person who he is today? And what stunted that ability to grow into the person that, he will be at the end of the novel.
That's a wonderful message. And I applaud this author. What was his name? Dickens? Oh, I'm right. 175 years later, we are still, I am still enthralled by this story.
So now it's called A Christmas Carol, and the chapters are called staves, or staffs as we call them on this side of the ocean. And so it's very much constructed as, a piece of music, ekphrasis, as we say. So it's told in words, but it has that sort of musicality, the harmonious feeling between the five chapters or staves. And of course, the title gives us that musicality as well. So I think that's sort of what you're getting at, Steve, is that despite the heavy-handed message, it's sort of wrapped up in this musicality. And I think there are a few places where we got Dickens's trademark humor, but this isn't as funny as his darker novels, okay? So David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, those are dark, dark novels, but boy, they're funny as well. And so having not read the other Christmas stories, and I don't even know the stories, I don't think, although we'll find out, I'm kind of interested to see if we get that biting wit for which Dickens is rather well known, or if he keeps it rather light and musical throughout these Christmas stories. So I'm just going to be watching for that as we read on.
Well, I'm blown away because I read the story. I didn't even catch this part. This is the reason why we have three of us here, to catch little things, because A Christmas Carol being music, and then it's the staves. Mm-hmm. I don't play an instrument, but certainly a person who plays an instrument would immediately recognize, like, oh, so there's a lot of playfulness in this story, and I think that is. Oh, what a beautiful insight. What a little thing to uncover right there.
The idea of the musicality of not only this story, not only storytelling itself, but just living a life. The beginning, middle, and end, the past, present, and future of this rhythm of life is on display here. I think that's a brilliant thing that he was able to put together in this idea of musicality.
And, one of the key themes, obviously, as we all noted as we were prepping for this, is the issue of time, right? Mm-hmm. So, each of us has a limited amount of time on this earth. How do we use it? And then how do we pull together the past, the present, the future? How do we do that psychologically? But also, how do we do it ethically, right? And the issue of time is, of course, nowhere more central in aesthetics than it is in music. Because you can only process music in time, right? Like an image, you can process all at once. But music is this relationship between, it cuts across time. And so I think that's another sort of, epistemological movement that's happening with the music and the focus on time.
So I'm just going to say this, that we needed a disclosure at the beginning to basically listen to this at a hookah bar, because you're blowing my mind. this is, I was like, oh, that is so cool, because music is in time. Uh-huh. And time is such a essential part of this story. Right. And go ahead.
And when you're writing music, and I am a musician, and so when you're writing music or performing music, you have to stay within the strict time that the composer has given you. But then when you leave time, that's a really important moment too. And I don't want to say this, I feel like A Christmas Carol never leaves the beat that it has set. right? So if we're going to do this in 3/4 time, it's in 3/4 time all the way through all 5 staves. You see it all coming. So, but I'm curious because typically a ghost story does sort of interrogate notions of time. Because you guys, when someone's dead, we often think of them as dead and we're not going to be interacting with them anymore. When a ghost shows up, it sort of blows open your notion of life, death, mortality, time. And so to me, one of the interesting things about this novel is that it keeps that strict time despite thematically having ghosts appear, which should unbalance time, but don't, and instead create this sort of like ethically comfortable notion of how to live a life. So it's pretty interesting.
But we're also leaving time. I think your insight is wonderful, because we're leaving it when he goes, when Marley shows up as a ghost. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in effect, he's immortal. So he's outside the beat of the carol.
Yep.
Okay, but when the ghost, we have 3 ghosts appearing over 3 nights, but it really is only 1 night. So time during this period sort of hits another dimension, another area. It's outside the music of life, which is finite, which is basically brought up in this, is that we're all more moral. And ultimately, it looks like the legacy you have, that basically when we go visit the different areas where other people and those experiences impact you, you end up having the ability to have your stream of life flow through, you know, another potentially. Your positive experiences, your negative experiences certainly have impact on another person far beyond that just one moment.
You said moral instead of mortal. Do you want to say that
again? I would actually like to not correct that, because I thought that was a wonderful slip, because I think that's exactly what Dickens is saying in this novel, because he's saying, yeah, we are all mortal and we are all moral, whether we're acting that way or not. We just need to find that morality. And he uses immortality to help us find that.
Wow.
Here we go.
Here, I wanted to jump in and be like, cool slip, Chip.
Here we go. Whoa.
Philosopher Chip this week on Sandwiches at Irregular Hours.
No, you're awesome.
There's so much to the idea of time, and technically this is time travel in this story, where we are traveling back to the past to relive those moments that are just memories, but actually being able to see them as if they're happening before us. I know this is not technically time travel. Don't get me wrong. But
you want to see time travel everywhere, Steve.
I love this story because there's time travel and because there's 2 Doctor Who episodes with Dickens and this story. And I watched both of them this morning in preparation for this show.
Awesome.
Noted.
So the structure of this is so well put together. This 3-night event where we go deep into the past, the Christmases that have been, the present, what is happening right now, despite the fact that the perspective of the main character is very narrow, and his perspective gets very widened by this experience. And then that potential of the future, that idea that mortality, he's going to die one day, and what is he going to do today in order to not have those experiences that he sees in the future? This is... I don't know how he put this together in such a way that you could have this so well done. And the idea of the 3 nights winding up being only one night? Is this all a dream? Is this all a fantasy? Is this all a bit of mustard? There's more of gravy than of grave of you is one of my favorite jokes in this thing, especially because in the Muppet version, that was Statler and Waldorf saying that that was a funny line to Ebenezer Scrooge and heckling him like they would Fozzie Bear. I love it.
And we haven't even talked about how one of the coolest things about this is that the term Scrooge comes from here. And we all know that term as like a Scrooge is another word for a miser, right? And so it's always great when you get to go back and read the text that gave you a word that you're familiar with.
So let's talk a little bit about Scrooge being miserable. And objectively, you know, it looks like he's an honest person who's incredibly successful. And if we had to add up sort of his impact on society, I think that you could objectively say that it looks like, you know, he's having a positive impact. He has all the means to buy something that he wishes. So if he said, I want to travel, he could travel. If he wanted a bigger house, he could have a bigger house. If he wanted better food, he could have other food. He has so many choices, things that are in his control. But why is he so miserable?
And why is he represented as so miserable, right? Because whenever you see a story like this, where you have a lot of poor people who are happy because they have their family and this one lonely rich guy, you have to kind of question, like, what's the moral here? Okay, so on the surface, the moral is, hey, the rich guy should give some of his money to the poor people. But if we want to think a little deeper, are we condoning a totally inequitable society where a very small percentage of people are actually controlling a huge percentage of resources, right? Because the Cratchits are represented as they're really happy. They're such a nice, close-knit family. And, you know, they're poor, but they have the pleasure of family and happiness. And it's so funny to read this compared to Dickens's other novels, which do quite different socio-cultural analysis, socio-economic analysis. So all Scrooge needs to do is share his resources and he'll be happy too.
Is that really the reason why he's miserable? Because he doesn't have a family, he doesn't share his resources?
I mean, is that not sort of what this novel is suggesting?
I don't think it's suggesting that. I think he's miserable because he chooses. I mean, he chooses not to live right here. He chooses not to interact with the people around him or the society around him.
I think one of the morals is the focus on business versus the focus on family. The past where he had this girl and they were in love and they were going to get married, but his focus on his aspirations to business made her leave him.
Well, that was his decision to be alone. But, I mean, certainly people can be alone and still be happy. And they can still have impact on society. They can be charitable and all those other things. You don't have to have a family to do that.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Chip. That's exactly what I'm saying, is that the moral message in this story is pretty simplistic, right? It's like, you know, if you get married and have many children, you'll be really happy, whether you have resources or not. And in fact, like, if you don't have enough resources to feed those children and to get medical assistance for your disabled child, I don't know. I'm not sure I buy that you'll be happy as long as a miser comes along and gives you a handout once a year. Right? So, I mean, it's a complicated moral message.
But at the same time, it's very simplistic in the he's alone, he's sad, he's miserable. He could choose to be less miserable, but he's stuck in this empty house, and he's miserable.
And it's probably because of some of the experiences he's had in the past. Mm-hmm. And maybe potentially, you know, he's a coward, especially in his personal affairs. I mean, that's where we see his past. When he's confronted with his past, what does he see? He sees, you know, being alone at a school. And his sister coming home to say, hey, you can come home now. But it's just not, you know, these type of events certainly had an impact on how he is, you know, he creates his circle and things of that nature. And he's so afraid of being poor that when he's at Fezziwig's party, which is ultimately the mentor that he wanted, I mean, that showed him how to be happy, that showed them how to have a great time with the people who are working with him, along with with Fezziwig's family, certainly should have been a model of how to live the future. Somehow he is not able to move beyond that, and he leaves his girlfriend during that time. Part of that is this forgetfulness, this inability to use his life experience, the positive life experiences, to grow beyond where he was as a child. In many ways, his personal life is a childish life.
And I think that the message there, in part, is his experiences as a very young child, where he was sent away, where he felt like he was not a part of the family, and the sister came to tell him that he was allowed back to the home for the holiday. That's there's some darkness to Dickens' writing here. The question of finding that one person, finding that spouse, would his life have come out differently if he had kept that relationship with that one girl? That one girl maybe was the key to not only his misery, but potentially to living a different life here.
So that's the real issue, isn't it? Is that they're at Fezziwig's, they're at this party, and his... Who could be the spouse? Basically, his connection to the personal life, and being the person that he wants to be. I mean the person that he could be is what it ultimately is. The connection to that would give him the humanity is not the proper word. It's the ability to reach out far beyond what he can do himself. He can run his business, and certainly he is skilled at that, but he can't run his private life with the same skill. And that's what potentially their partnership could have been, because she certainly had other goals that he wasn't willing to entertain. And he basically is willing to abandon them because of what I would say is fear for maybe what happened to him earlier at the school situation.
I imagine here Bill and Melinda Gates. Bill Gates was a very focused young man, and when he met his spouse, Melinda, she was a very different kind of person, and together they work really well. Yes, they are incredibly rich. They have all the means available to them, but she pushes him to get out of his shell and to be a part of society in ways that he probably never would had she not asked him to.
And in fact, Warren Buffett works very similarly. Interesting, Gates and Buffett have a connection there, but Buffett's wife left him and moved to San Francisco. But anyway, she runs the charitable arm of Berkshire Hathaway. You know, it's not uncommon. I mean, think of Dolly Madison and her connection to James Madison and ultimately Thomas Jefferson. She basically created the decorum for representing the United States in many ways. So, I mean, there's just so much. I think these partnerships in today's society, we may be underestimating them, because there is a reason why many people can become successful and also have a positive impact on the world. And partnerships allow them to do it. And you can look at any politician out there, and many of them are pairs.
Mm-hmm. And I love that we've come back to this question of philanthropy, because that brings us right back to the question of the power of literature, right? So, because there's a lot of research in how people choose to make philanthropic gifts, and it's typically stories that do it rather than statistics, right? And so when we get, I think that's part of what Dickens is sort of showing us and intuiting 175 years ago, is that the story of Tiny Tim is more powerful than all the sociological research that's being done on the disparity and the levels of poverty in early Victorian England. This is what makes people open their wallets. It's a story like A Christmas Carol. It's a story of transformation rather than a story of statistics.
So we've got lots of other characters in this story, too. We've got Scrooge's nephew and his employee, Bob Cratchit, here. So there's a lot of relationships, not just the spousal relationships, that Scrooge is not good at here. So how does this relationship with the nephew change Scrooge?
Let me just ask in a different way. The nephew made decisions in his life, and Scrooge wasn't very happy with it. And Scrooge is also very critical of Bob Cratchit and his situation in life and the choices he makes. So we've got two people. The nephew chose to get married out of love. They're poor but happy. Bob Cratchit has lots of children. They're poor, and he doesn't really know it yet, but you know, he's got a son that's has some medical needs. What Scrooge is withholding from these two is his ability to make their lives better. That inability to mentor these two people. Like, listen, you made a choice to get married and you know, you're poor and happy and stuff like that, but I'm really good at going out there and making resources. Let me show you how you can be happy in life, your personal life, and also be able to afford to do this and have an impact and all those good things that you're good at. You know, the dinner party and all the other things that you're part of, you know, you can have a bigger impact there. And for Bob Cratchit, you know, you're very skilled at working with me. You put up with me. You've got all this home life that I'm so critical of. Why don't I show you how you can not only do this, but I can help you grow and allow me the opportunity to go and do something that makes me happy. Certainly Bob Cratchit seems like he's perfectly capable of running that that office. So this is the real challenge of this, is that I don't see that Scrooge is critical, but certainly not willing to jump in and help them.
And I think that we really see Dickens's writing at a very, very high level as he's thinking about these, both Bob Cratchit and his nephew. So let me pull out just a couple of quotations. So when Scrooge is looking at the Cratchit family, check this out. "And now Scrooge looked on more attentively than ever, when the master of the house, having his daughter leaning fondly on him, sat down with her and her mother at his own fireside. And when he thought that such another creature, quite as graceful and as full of promise, might have called him father, and been a springtime in the haggard winter of his life, his sight grew very dim indeed." So as Scrooge watches this man with his wife and his daughter, who I think is nearly grown, Scrooge starts thinking, whoa, I'm totally alone. In the winter of my life, I wish I had a child, a springtime, right? Someone who was much earlier in their life to fill out the end of my life. And similarly, when he looks at his nephew, he sees, and this is kind of a really fun quote, I think. "It is a fair, even-handed, noble adjustment of things that while there is infection in disease and sorrow, there is nothing in the world so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humor. When Scrooge's nephew laughed in this way, holding his sides, rolling his head, and twisting his face into the most extravagant contortions, Scrooge's niece by marriage laughed as heartily as he, and their assembled friends, being not a bit behindhand, roared out lustily." So here's the other thing that Scrooge sees. You think infection, you think disease is infectious? You know what's really infectious? Laughter. So in both of these scenes, we see this really, again, simplistic notion of what gives you happiness, friends and family. It's simplistic, true, but it's also sort of very much telling you this is how you need to live your life. So I feel like there's a sort of complex ethical element to this representation.
Well, certainly they're being represented right there as family. But I don't think today's reader has to look at it that way.
Right, exactly.
And there's, I mean, this is why it kind of transcends the time it was written. Mm-hmm. Is we certainly can look at it with today's eyes and make different choices, but still, you know, find a way to make happiness, or recognize that your attitude or your the way you present yourself certainly could have a negative impact on people. I mean, they're laughing at him because of who he's become, not because they wouldn't want to have his, I guess, talent on one level, but certainly they don't want to be him in another way.
It's amazing how often we've come back to this is such a simplistic story, but at the same time, it has such depth to it that it's transcended time. 175 years later, this is a great way to look at life's choices, both from a childish perspective and as somebody at the end of their life. Like, we should be finding the time to use our resources to be with people. Boy, I really miss people.
Not being plugged into society has made him a very unhappy person.
And that's what COVID does.
A story we need more than ever right now.
Laughter is more infectious than disease. I don't know.
Sorry, so let's really go down to the heart of it. Is Dickens suggesting that Scrooge is morally obligated to help his nephew and Bob Cratchit?
I don't know if he's saying morally obligated, but I think he's saying he'll be happier if he does. Right, he'll be rewarded through happiness here on Earth if he does.
So, is that the message? Is that the is the message that your life on Earth is the most important part, and therefore you need to share not only your resources, but your time with others?
Well, the nephew and Bob Cratchit are both introduced. And we are introduced to the Christmas party that the nephew is throwing, and also the family party that the Cratchits are having. And both of those, Scrooge is not aware because of the impact he's having on their lives, which for the nephew, all he does is invite them, and they're going to go on with their life with or without him. So he certainly is true. And the Cratchits, you know, certainly Mrs. Cratchit is very critical of Scrooge, and Mr. Cratchit is certainly much more, you know, recognizing the alternative to not working with Scrooge. And certainly making the best of things. But, you know, I'm not sure that Dickens is saying, listen, I'm interested in a situation where we have to force Scrooge to be part of this. But when Scrooge becomes aware of it, he's certainly saying that that Scrooge has the ability to have a very positive impact on those people's lives. And certainly Tiny Tim, you know, it's a matter of life and death.
Mm-hmm. So is there religion in Christmas in this story, Pam?
Oh, yeah. So, of course, as we've talked about before, the Victorian period is this time of epistemological change where we have real clashes between religion and science. And I feel like this novel's pretty interesting in how it navigates the sacred and the secular. It's a pretty secular story in a lot of ways, in that, you know, Scrooge doesn't seem super religious, and he's kind of looking from a very sort of business-oriented perspective at the world. But then when we get into the Cratchit household, there's this moment I think is really interesting when Bob comes home with Tiny Tim. And Mrs. Cratchit's like, so was Tiny Tim, how did he behave? And here's the quote from Bob Cratchit. As good as gold, said Bob, and better. Somehow he gets thoughtful, sitting by himself so much, and thinks the strangest things you ever heard. He told me, coming home, that he hoped that people saw him in the church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see. And so this little boy, Tiny Tim, whose life is very much in jeopardy because he doesn't have access to medical care, has somehow internalized the message that that's okay. This is God's will. Like, God will either make him make lame beggars walk or will not. But either way, he's comfortable that this is really God's decision. So it's not incumbent upon the society to provide medical care for this little boy. It's up to God. So that has long been a narrative that's sometimes internalized by oppressed people, but that actually has quite a lot more benefit to the haves than the have-nots. So the representation of that message, I think, is really interesting. And then shortly thereafter, when Scrooge is having a conversation with, I think it's the ghost of the present, but now I'm forgetting, they have this conversation where the ghost says something that kind of made me pause. I don't know if you guys paused here. The spirit says, "There are some upon this earth of yours," returned the spirit, "who lay claim to know us, and who do their deeds of passion, pride, ill will, hatred, envy, bigotry, and selfishness in our name, who are as strange to us and all our kith and kin as if they had never lived. Remember that, and charge their doings on themselves, not us." It's an interesting moment where this spirit says, a lot of people try to use God's name to justify actions. And yeah, that's be careful about that. You can't, just because someone says they're doing something in the name of God doesn't make it so. So to me, like, those were two moments where I was like, oh, this is the Dickens that I know, the one who's really critical of class, who's really like doing early proto-Marxist analysis in the first half of the 19th century. Those were the moments where I paused and was like, you know, because this story about, oh yeah, a miser sees happy people who are, despite their extreme poverty, happy in their friendships and their love. And the miser will philanthropically give out exactly however much he feels is necessary and all will be good. But that's not really Dickens' message from my perspective of having read, you know, some of the meatier Dickens novels. And so these were moments where I was like, oh yeah, I'm recognizing Charles Dickens here.
Because generally it's a very human message. It is not a very spiritual message, despite the fact that there are these spirits. But that was one of those moments in the story where the spirits bring up this idea of, oh, look, there's something beyond this life. There's something beyond what you can see. And maybe, just maybe, you'll have some sort of afterlife that is tied to your choices.
So is Marley in hell?
He's got the chains. I think so. Yes. The chains that I forged in life, Ebenezer. Yeah, I think that is the idea of eternal punishment, for sure.
Sure. And the people around him, certainly, when he goes to the Ghost of Christmas Future, and he sees that, you know, what could be, and how poorly Scrooge treated those around him. You know, they're selling his curtains, they're selling this stuff. They're not thinking of him as a person. He didn't treat people well. They certainly are not going to remember him in a positive light.
And no mention of any punishment specific for Scrooge there. It's all very earthbound, the idea of the possessions being taken. No real deep philosophical idea about afterlife in that section.
Well, in the first chapter, I mean, Marley says that Ebenezer has his chains have grown since his death. So that was one of the mentions earlier in the novel, is that not only did Marley die, but Ebenezer's Scrooge's chains that he was putting together have continued to grow.
But is that philosophical or is that metaphorical for his feelings here on Earth?
Well, for Marley, they're real. So if Scrooge would have died the moment before Marley showed up, it sounds like that he would be with Marley right beside him with his own set of chains.
So well written. this is the worst analysis I've ever done of a book, because I just really enjoy that ability of Dickens to put both of those juxtapositions there for us, but we can choose to ignore them and just go with the basics of the story very easily.
And I think that the niece and nephew in some ways give us the strongest analysis of the situation. In this passage where at the party, "I'm sure he is very rich, Fred," hinted Scrooge's niece. "At least you always tell me so." "What of that, my dear?" said Scrooge's nephew. "His wealth is of no use to him. He don't do any good with it. He don't make himself comfortable with it. He hasn't the satisfaction of thinking, ha ha ha, that he's ever going to benefit us with it." "I have no patience with him," observed Scrooge's niece. Scrooge's niece's sisters and all the other ladies expressed the same opinion. "Oh, I have," said Scrooge's nephew. "I'm sorry for him. I couldn't be angry with him if I tried. Who suffers by his ill whims? Himself, always. Here he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come and dine with us. What's the consequence? He don't lose much of a dinner." Now, to me, what's interesting here is that, once again, this is them justifying, like, well, he doesn't owe us anything, whatever, and he'll get his just reward later, because you know who is going to benefit? You know who's going to inherit his wealth? It's these people who he doesn't even like. He can't even enjoy that he's going to be giving his wealth to the next generation, because he doesn't even get to know them or like them. And so this is one of those scenes where you get those two narratives at once. The really nice Christmassy one that you've really enjoyed, Steve, but also the like critical class-based analysis one that like, this is really a problem.
There's a leap, there's an assumption in there that Scrooge hasn't designated to go someplace. And it could have been, it doesn't necessarily have to go to the niece and nephew. You once again, he's pretty angry.
They're making that assumption, sure.
Yeah, he's angry with his nephew for making this marriage. But ultimately, I think that was the part where Scrooge's nephew says, "I feel sorry for him," because they're not wealthy, but they're enjoying their time. Once again, Scrooge has all the resources he needs and just is a miserable guy. He doesn't have to be. He doesn't have to go to his nephews to be happy, but it's certainly once he learns about, oh, what could be, a lot of people, you know, struggle with visioning of what they would like. And it seems like Scrooge is still stuck, you know, in the past, really unable to let go of it, to be able to enjoy the moment.
Mm-hmm. And that's quite a message of, don't be stuck in the past. Look at the past. Look at from a perspective of an old person like we are, at those ideas, those stories that happened to you in the past, and don't get mired in those. Don't get stuck in that. Look at the present. I think it's the present where he really has that change of attitude more than in the past.
Amy Adams was just given an interview concerning the Hillbilly Elegy movie. And she was actually talking about her daughter. And one of the messages of Hillbilly Elegy was how where you come from and the experiences you have impact how you view life. And as parents, you know, what Amy Adams was talking about, her relationship with her daughter certainly resonates, would be any parent. Any bad experience you had in life, anything that you had, you would want to shelter that from your child. In the sense of, you wouldn't want them, that's not like, hey, listen, I suffered, let me watch you suffer so you can experience it with me. So most parents would not want that to happen. And she was saying that is one of the real tragedies of that movie, is that as much as we like to protect them, sometimes we are the ones inflicting it, our pains onto the future. And Scrooge, you know, certainly could be an example of that.
Are we ready to go to the end of this story?
Let's go with the end.
There's an end? There's an end to this story, Pam?
There's an end. Merry Christmas.
And some people say, God bless us, everyone.
Well, So we have Scrooge saying to Bob Cratchit, "My goodness, I'm going to raise your salary, buddy, and Merry Christmas to all."
And we're going to have a warm office.
Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all and infinitely more. And to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew, or any good old city, town, or borough in the good old world. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh, and little heeded them. For he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset. And knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins as have the malady in less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. He had no further intercourse with spirits, but lived upon the total abstinence principle ever afterwards, and it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be truly said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone! Exclamation point.
That's great. That's wonderful.
So let's go get a sherry and meet in the parlor and then talk about this book now.
Well, we could see how this has been adapted so many times. This story has been utilized so many times. It brings me back to Doctor Who, of course. There are two Doctor Who episodes. The one where the Doctor and Rose go on a ghostly adventure with Charles Dickens himself. That's the Unquiet Dead. And then there's A Christmas Carol, where the Doctor plays the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future to change the attitude of a miser. These are beautiful stories of how this season can melt the heart of a cold person, and his heart grew 4 sizes that day. That's a different story, isn't it? That's a completely different. We should read that one next.
Really excited to read these next Charles Dickens Christmas ghost stories next, because I have no idea what to expect.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, that was one of the conversations we had as we were kind of putting this together, is we know Christmas Carol so well, and we're going to skip over the next publication date because it is a New Year's story. We'll save that one for later. So we're going to read 1845, The Cricket on the Hearth, which was adapted into a Rankin-Bass story, which the stop animation for all the Rudolph and the Red-Nosed Reindeer fans out there. But I don't think I've ever read it, and I couldn't tell you what the story is.
I have no idea what this story is going to be about, but I'm curious as to whether or not we know this story, whether or not we have been told this tale, but we just didn't know the title. Maybe. We'll find out next week.
We'll have to ask the little matchstick girl.
That's a totally different story.
Well, then we'll ask the Blue Fairy.
There's a Christmas episode for just about everything, but yes, we'll have to find out what the cricket is doing on the hearth. Hopefully he's staying warm.
And I've had the Tooth Fairy at my house 3 times in the past 3 weeks.
So what?
Magic in the world right now.
My goodness.
It's that time of year, that's for
it
sure.
It is.
I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
What do you think, Pam?
I'm in.
All right. So we're going to read The Cricket on the Hearth, which was published in 1845, next week. Find that in our show notes, and we will be full of Christmas cheer and make it a merry for everyone. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're at Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. And God bless us, everyone. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm the ghost of Christmas present, Chip Hasenblatt.
and I'm just plain old Pompadour.
See you in Christmas future.